Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Steve Keen, a renowned Australian economist and author. Through his work in popular books such as Debunking Economics and Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis, his weekly podcast and relentless Twitter activity, Professor Steve strives to educate the world of the failings of neoclassical economics and highlight the risks of the insatiable drive for more debt in modern society. Damien.
Yeah, thanks. Look, I wanted to get Steve on this week, not only because he's often got a different view on and a different take on a number of different economic themes that are out there. The main one we wanted to really focus on was the debt side, though. So as regular listeners will know, we've been focusing a little bit, especially on the Australian debt side, but also on Chinese debt and global debt as well. But what we're really trying to look for is the signs where we're trying to where we're reaching the end and trying to work out how far can it be pushed. So in particular, the Australian market, where we're pretty focused on the housing construction sector and how the Morrison government's trying to push more debt onto the world's second most indebted consumer, and we really wanted to grab a debt expert just to explore some of the themes around this. So and Steve made a perfect guest for that.
Fantastic. Yep. So, and just remember, after the interview, we'll also look into how some of these wider investment implications can impact how we run models every day here at Nucleus Wealth. And also, we've pre-shot today's interview, but we are available live now to answer any questions at the end. And as always, we're open to any guests or topic selections as well. So feel free to drop in any suggestions along the way. I hope you enjoy. So today on the show, we have economist, author, and honorary professor of the University College of London, Professor Steve Keen. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Good to be here.
So Steve, just to get our listeners up to speed, if you wouldn't mind just providing a little bit of background on yourself and why you feel the need to debunk economics.
Okay, that goes back a long way. In fact, it's almost coming up to 50 years since I realised economic was bunkum. That was back in 1971 when I was doing an undergraduate degree in arts and law at Sydney University. And was exposed to a theory I shouldn't have learned about in first year called the theory of the second best. And that was a theory that said that if you're two steps from economic nirvana, what happens if you take one step closer to it? And the answer was you make welfare worse. In other words, the only way to, you have a supply and demand analysis said it's best not to have trade unions, better not to have monopolies. So you should abolish them both. But if you have them both and you abolish one but not the other, you actually make the welfare situation worse. And I thought, what? This would look like a cut and dried argument in favour of abolishing, you know, getting rid of trade unions to make, weakening them, which is, of course, what's happened in the last 40 or 50 years. You look at a slightly more realistic theory that says there's both, you know, concentrated buyers of labour as well as unions of sellers, and getting rid of one of both makes things worse. There's got to be something wrong with the theory. So I dived into the journals rather than the textbooks, found an entire debate on the foundations of economics, which was not turning up in the textbooks, called the Capital Controversies. Realised that, in fact, Samuelson, who was a conservative and, of course, pushed the mainstream economics, conceded defeat in that debate in 1966. He didn't admit it in his textbook. The textbooks themselves continued presenting that the neoclassical ideas were right. I just thought this thing is, and the further I looked at it, the more flaws I found in conventional economic theory, some of which have been discovered by conventional economists and either buried by them or communicated as advances rather than fundamental contradictions. And I thought somebody has to take this on, and I started doing so in the book Debunking Economics back in 2001.
And
I've been getting worse.
Yeah, it sounds shocking, Steve. So you're trying to tell us that people use economics as a fig leaf to just do what they wanted to in the first place. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, not consciously. I mean, it's as if we still believe that the Earth is the centre of the universe and all the planets are rotating around us and the sun and the moon. And then we're trying to organise moonshots. And we wonder why the rockets keep on crashing rather than hitting their targets. Fundamentally, we've got a Ptolemaic model of a Copernican world in economics, and that is, people then end up having beliefs in that system as a form of ideology when they're not even conscious that it is one.
Yes, exactly, and I think that's probably where, you know, I think probably where I first started seeing your research was sort of around the whole debt issues, sort of you know, around the financial crisis. So do you want to give us a quick you know, quick oversight of what you see in terms of the main issues in terms of how economics treats debt or ignores it, I guess, versus how you said.
Yeah, like mainstream economics completely ignores private debt. And probably the best summary of that is given by Ben Bernanke in his book Essays on the Great Depression, which was basically his job application for being Federal Reserve Governor. And in that, he said that he rejected Irving Fisher's explanation of the Great Depression, which was the debt deflation theory. And Fisher said that you know, that there was too much private debt and prices, inflation was too low, and that combination gave you the setting point for setting off the Great Depression. And Bernanke dreamt up another way to rephrase partly what Fisher had said, but fundamentally he said that this explanation had was not accepted in academic economics because of the counter-argument that debt is a pure redistribution, and absent implausibly large differences in spending powers between the saver and the borrower, pure distribution should have no macroeconomic impact. Now, that's fundamentally modelling banks as being intermediaries, being agents between buyers, between borrowers and lenders, not actually creating debt themselves and not creating money. That's all garbage, and it's been known to be garbage for 60 or 70 years by people who are practitioners in the area, but mainstream economists stick with this model because it means they can ignore banks, ignore debt, and ignore money when they do their macroeconomic models, and that's what they've done.
It makes it a lot easier, doesn't it? It makes the maths a lot easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it actually makes their maths easier, but their maths, exactly. I call their mathematics mathematics. Yeah. You've got numbers and symbols and looks like it's mathematically sophisticated to anybody who can be intimidated by that stuff, and they think it's sophisticated. But in fact, it's static non-equilibrium. It's a static equilibrium thinking when we live in a dynamic non-equilibrium world. So when you admit that banks create money, which is what the Bank of England and the Bundesbank have now confirmed, so they're supporting the rebels rather than the mainstream, what I've added into it is proof that credit is part of aggregate demand and aggregate income. So the mainstream models demand as if it's entirely due to the turnover of existing money fundamentally, and changes in the money they think are caused by government, so government policy changes. In the real world, banks create money, and when they create that money, people who borrowed it don't borrow for the sheer pleasure of being in debt. They borrow to spend. Their spending increases demand. It's not offset by a fall in spending by anybody else. And equally, when people pay their debt backwards, when they pay their debt down, that works in reverse. So rather than credit adding to aggregate demand when it's positive, when credit is negative, it reduces aggregate demand. That's what let me see the financial crisis coming. That fundamental logic, I hadn't worked it out as thoroughly as I have now. But the mainstream ignores all this stuff, so they can't understand why the financial crisis happened, and they can't understand why the global economy is relatively stagnant after it rather than before, recovering is the way they thought it would. So they've left out the most volatile and most important determinant of economic performance from their models, which is no wonder why they're wrong.
And so there's a pretty good argument that, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, you know, the central banks have this policy, have this lever they're called monetary policy, where they put interest rates up and demand slows, and they put interest rate down and demand increases. And so I guess they're sort of sitting there pulling this lever up and down, but sort of ignoring the fact that pretty much what that lever's done, especially when they're pulling the lever, you know, putting interest rates down, is all it's doing is increasing debt in these economies, which is then creating the demand. But they're ignoring the fact that that debt can't keep increasing forever. You can't keep growing debt at a rate greater than income, because you sort of end up with those you know, the over indebtedness, as you said, that sort of caused the Great Depression in the first place. And And as you said, so do you think central banks are starting to get towards that? So you spoke about a few banks that are starting to acknowledge that possibly the issue, or do you think there's still
a long, slow process, because you've got people committed to a particular way of thinking about the economy, and they're not about to abandon that just because it's been proven wrong. This is it's a trait of humanity to hang on to beliefs, you know, well and truly after they've passed their use by date. And the economists, far from being an exception, they're probably the rule on that front. There are only one individual that I can target in neoclassical economics who's always understood this and always included the role of private debt in his economic models, which are mainstream neoclassical models. And that's Michael Kumhoff, who's the chief economic advisor to the Bank of England. And Michael continues presenting papers where credit has an impact on aggregate demand, where the changes in the level of credit affect the economy. And he's now experiencing what I've experienced, that the mainstream won't even listen to him, even though his stuff fits the data and theirs doesn't. So it's a very, very slow process to make that change, and there's no guarantee that it'll be successful. They could continue with these false beliefs as they did after the Great Depression.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess looking around at some of the major central banks, and we're particularly interested in the Reserve Bank of Australia at the moment, our take would seem to be that they seem to be sort of behind the curve or I guess a lot more traditional in their thinking than other central banks at the moment.
Behind the curve, they can't even see that there's a curve. we had Clark, I think it was, who came out, Kent, who came out and basically gave a statement about the banks create money that was fairly similar to what the Bank of England and the Bundesbank have already said, in a much more detailed way. But he's one of the non-orthodox thinkers inside the RBA. Fisher and Kent wrote the only paper the RBA ever published that I frequently quote, which compares the 1890s depression in Australia to the 1930s, and said the 1890s was far worse because of the far higher level of bank credit and the far higher level of bank failures after the crisis compared to the Great Depression. And so I'm not amazed that it was, I think it was Kent who came out with an argument that was consistent with what the Bank of England was saying and the Bundesbank. But in terms of their actual thinking at the RBA, they're probably even more further behind the curve than the Federal Reserve is. So there's been no, like the latest paper put out by Dr. Tulip, and I still find that name so bloody funny. Dr.
Tulip. And you're in Amsterdam at the moment as well, aren't you?
Pardon?
And you are in Amsterdam, Tulip Central at the moment.
Yes, from one tulip to another. The model they have has no role for banking in it. When they talk about credit, they're talking about responses from bank lending offices as to how available the access to credit is. They're not talking about the volume of credit. So you've got a brand new model, I think it's called Martin, put out by the Federal Reserve. They have credit conditions in it. They have a couple of elements about the interest rates and stuff like that, but nothing about the aggregate level of credit. And that is what actually drives the volatility in aggregate demand. So, yeah, they're miles behind the curve, and I don't think they're ever going to catch up.
Mm. And so the Federal Reserve, I guess, so if you're ranking sort of the major central banks, are we going, is it the Bank of England, then Federal Reserve, then ECB, or are we... I've got the order right. In terms of getting closer to the right answer, in terms of actually acknowledging.
The ranking goes Bank of England, Bundesbank, Bank of Norway, to some extent, the Central Bank of Sweden, though I'm not particularly convinced in that. People who've left the ECB are like Vito Constanza, who recently stood down from the board of the ECB. He's now coming out with sensible stuff, which he couldn't say when he was on the ECB board. Even Draghi's come up with slightly more sensible stuff. But in terms of inside the central banks, particularly the Fed and the ECB, they suppress the expression of these thoughts, even if some of their staff have them.
Mm. And Bank of Japan?
I honestly don't know. The Bank of Japan, I mean, in many ways, the Bank of Japan has been practicing non-stop quantitative easing and a gigantic increase in government debt, which they finance by buying the debt indirectly off the treasury. Mm. So they've been doing that now for 25, 30 years. But in terms of an appreciation of the role of credit in aggregate demand, I haven't seen that in the Bank of Japan. The best spot in that sense is in acknowledging it is still the Bank of England with the Bundesbank in second place, and then it's daylight.
Mm. And then I guess the next step from there is China's obviously got a lot of differences in terms of its financial system. It's running some pretty big increases in debt at the moment, and playing around with reserve requirement ratios and other factors sort of seems to, it's got a lot of little levers it likes to try and pull rather than the one big interest rates up, interest rates down. You got any comments on sort of the few, I guess, where the limits might be in terms of Chinese debt and and how far away we are from it?
That's an interesting and complicated one, because China's increase in private debt was probably the fastest in the history of capitalism. This is one thing which I could actually pull up a couple of charts and look at the data, but there was a phenomenal increase in private sector debt in 2010, basically because the Communist Party told the banks to lend to anybody with a pulse, could give credit-based demand to make up for the collapse in export demand when the global financial crisis smashed Chinese exports by something of the order of 40%. And that's what set off the enormous housing bubble in China and all those, the ghost cities we've all seen. But it also, at the same time, they're doing enormous government-based funding, building the massive infrastructure across the country, building the Silk Road project and so on. And I think they've had a huge credit bust, which they've papered over. They're still trying to paper over it, but they've now got the Chinese population dependent upon rising house prices as sort of their form of long-term, that's their long-term pension system, effectively.
That sounds familiar, Steve.
They can't afford to let house prices fall because there'll be riots. So it's a complex mess. I think they can continue doing this for quite some time because the scale of government spending is dramatically larger than anything could be contemplated in the West. And they're using the Silk Road project, although they've forgotten the actual term they use for it, but that's the old
One Belt, One Road.
Yep. The One Belt, One Road thing, yeah. They're using that as a way of continuing to put financial stimulus onto the Chinese economy because it's all been built with Chinese labour and Chinese companies with Chinese goods in non-Chinese countries. And that's building infrastructure in between them and Asia on the way to Europe. And increasing output elements for Chinese business as well, while keeping their economy working gangbusters. So I think clearly the whole stuff over the amount of collapses that should be happening in the real estate sector in China is astronomical, but I think they're papering over it fairly dramatically.
Yeah, but does it feel to you as though they're in this part of, decreasing returns in terms of every dollar of debt. You need a lot more dollars of debt now to generate that growth, and the size of the debt and the size of their economy now means that it was much easier to double your debt when your debt was 20% or 30% of GDP, whereas now as it keeps growing and growing and growing, you're sitting on this massive pile of where getting the growth because you've turned so huge is just more and more difficult.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's just a question of how they cope with it, because what normally happens with Western governments when this thing occurs is that there's a private debt bubble, like there was in Australia from 1993 on, and the government in the meantime uses the extra revenue that generates to pay down government debt. And says, aren't we great managers? We're reducing government debt. What that actually means is there's less government money creation, which encourages people even more to go into the private bank borrowing, and you get even more of a bubble, then it bursts and collapses. Well, the Chinese are doing is actually they used the private sector to stimulate the economy in 2010 to reverse the impact of the collapse in export markets for China and drag people back from the countryside back into the factories again. But they at the same time they simultaneously pushed on the infrastructure button with both domestic projects and the One Belt One Road project, and that's feasible for a government to do that potentially indefinitely wherever its currency is accepted. So this huge government at the same time as a huge private sector debt bubble, we've never had that combination before globally. And it, even though it sounds worse, it actually means one excess can balance the other excess and it can go on for much longer. So I think they potentially can. It's like as if you had the 1929 bust happening, and at the same time, Roosevelt brings them the New Deal. Okay, so one approach papers over the damage caused by the other, and the economy doesn't fall into a hole. So I'm still debating with myself whether China will have a large crisis. But the thing it's certainly got to face a slowdown in growth, as we're seeing in the real data rather than the fictional stuff they publish, because they basically use that technological leapfrogging approach as far as they can. And they simply can't maintain that same rate of real growth, but they can, what the thing is, they have a slowing down rate of real growth while trying to handle the aftermath of a credit bubble at the same time. So
Yeah.
I'm not able to call it either way.
Yeah, and it seems to us on our numbers, and they're very hard to get the sort of underlying figures as to what's actually happening. But certainly on the property side, it seems as if they're demolishing far greater levels than what you see elsewhere. So in the end, it's sort of a question of knocking down buildings to put up new buildings, and so that almost defines the Keynesians, digging holes to fill them in again type thing to keep your population busy. It's obviously not very productive for the broader society, but if your goal is just to keep people employed, then it works.
Yeah, and that seems to be what people don't realise the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party is responsive to their population more so than our so-called democracies in the West. And I had experienced that I was back in China in 1981, and I saw this very much firsthand. Because if there's a revolt by the peasants, boy, the peasants are revolting in China, and people literally get killed in those processes, and that causes a political shift at the top, which is what led to the fall of Mao. So this time around, we're well past those days of absolute subservience to the Communist Party's applied back then. But the party knows that if they don't keep the population happy, there'll be revolution of not the sort they want. So that fear of a kickback from the public actually puts more willingness on the Chinese Communists to deliver prosperity for their population than we get in the so-called democracies of the West.
Mm. Now you spoke a little bit about China being really reliant on house prices and keeping the peasants from revolting by trying to keep house prices high. That seems to draw a decent analogy with Australia, where the peasants would revolt as well if their house prices fell. And we've got a government now out trying to, I guess Australia's, I think, number two on world debt, so we're not. So it's not quite number one yet, but we're certainly pretty close, and we've got a prime minister looking to try and get new home buyers to borrow 95% of their loans because other people aren't increasing their debt fast enough. Mm-hmm. So on the flip side, you've got the RBA sort of begging them to spend, and the government not wanting to spend more money on infrastructure, and sort of had one extra difficulty to it, then they're running record immigration rates. So you sort of got these a couple of these factors trying to increase credit more, and credit seems to be pretty full and people not really wanting to borrow. Central banks trying to put down rates, but they're sort of getting pretty close to their limits. And then trying to pour more people in to keep those house prices high. There seems to be a lot of tensions there, and if you get it wrong, there's the potential for disaster. But if you keep pumping it up and throwing more policies at it, you can sort of keep house prices where they are. I'd like to hear your take on.
I think I was expecting the bubble to be like a it burst back in 2017, and it's been heading down substantially until the unexpected election of the Morrison government. Also after the Banking Royal Commission, I thought would be the kiss of death to it. Of course, the commission's hearing itself were brilliant, and Rowena always was devastating. But the report that was written by the bloody Treasury, and it basically turned the whole thing into a damp squib. And then within 6 months, we're back to trying to encourage irresponsible lending. And you get Friedenberg, the Treasurer, saying that for every 10% increase in house prices, there's a 0.5% increase in GDP. So we've now got a government explicitly dedicating to keeping house prices rising. That's an effective policy for the country in the long run. And at the same time, the whole place is being deindustrialized. You would have seen the Atlas of Economic Complexity rankings. Australia's fallen 16 places, has now got a slightly less complex economy than Senegal. It's an embarrassment to watch in many senses, because it's all come down to maintaining this house price bubble. And in one sense, they're right, because that's what's kept demand positive in the economy for as long as it has been positive. But you're at the saturation level, and we might have the world's second highest level of household debt to GDP. But that's, we're comparing ourselves to Switzerland. And Switzerland, first of all, runs a huge trade surplus, which Australia doesn't have. So in terms of globally, countries normally running trade deficits, we're number one. But also there's a lot of rather interesting accounting, I've been told, in Swiss banks. And I think if you take that stuff out of the equation, and the extent to which Switzerland is still the homes of the gnomes of Zurich, Australia's number one on that front, and they think they can continue going further. And I think we really are reaching a saturation point. You're getting the household sector to take on more credit just isn't going to happen. And now the government's back in with another glorified version of the first-time owners scheme.
So if we really want to avoid this hangover, so let's just keep drinking.
Exactly.
So I guess we're pretty focused on unemployment, I guess, as our big take on this in terms of saying, if you look, say, 2012 to 2017, Australia had this massive housing boom and credit-driven, very much so, and house prices in Sydney and Melbourne sort of were up astronomical amounts. But at the same time, we actually saw, with exactly the same conditions, we saw house prices in Perth fall. So same interest rates, same free credit, but rising unemployment was enough to sort of send prices down in Perth. So we're very focused on the whole, can employment keep going? And I guess what we're trying to look at is the construction sector in particular has really cratered. So despite house prices increasing, we haven't seen any sort of signs yet of recovery in the construction sector. Mm. And so our sort of thesis is, well, if that unemployment there filters out to the rest of the economy, then look out, I suppose, is where we're taking it. And I guess what we're trying to look for is whether you know of any other examples, globally where, house prices, sort of rising house prices, but no housing construction has actually led to an improving economy versus an economy that actually is just whether you're just teetering on the edge and you know the house prices might be rising, but it's your last final hurrah before the unemployment sort of kicks in and forces prices lower.
Yeah, well, the main factor, if you look at what's going to, like, the monetary demand for employment, it comes out of turnover of existing money, which has been declining in the West ever since we got the inflation spike of the 1980s. Newly created government money, where you've got a government trying to take money out of the economy with this recession and running a surplus, a trade surplus, and Australia's got a bit of one at the moment, but it's only running a trade deficit. And then the household sector borrowing, and the private sector borrowing more money off the banks. And we've reached, it's obvious that it looks like corporate borrowing has come down and bottomed to some extent. The household sector's reached as much credit as it can cope with as well. So you've got a whole lot of negative forces for demand overall. It's all being, what's left of the positive is all being focused on the house prices. But what you've got is a bunch of people in paupers living in mansions, fundamentally. Like, they're all they can do is afford to support their house price, pay the mortgage off, and service the mortgage, but they can't afford to spend. So you've got a combination of a rising house prices with a stagnant economy, and that ultimately will mean, well, people who are trying to keep their house prices rising and sustain their mortgage are going to lose their jobs, and then bang, they can't maintain the mortgage, and we're likely to see yet another government rescue based around trying to pump people back into the housing sector again. It's just pushing us into a corner where we have the most encumbered household sector on the planet, and they're trying to say spend more money. I mean,
yeah. Well, we've got the new home buyers. That's why they haven't got any debt yet. So if we give them 95%. That'll give us buy us another year or two, won't it?
That sort of thing.
That's a plan. Yeah.
You're pushing the whole policy is on trying to keep the house price rises going, which gives you a real estate stimulus, while the rest of the economy is falling into a hole, and that will be definitely an Aussie first.
Yeah, but but if you're not getting the construction coming through, then you haven't got a real estate stimulus. It's great to have house prices go and maybe people go out and buy a few new couches and stuff like that, but unless people are actually building, then the jobs are, you're limited to basically helping a few real estate agents and
lawyers. The stuff over the shoddy construction and people realising, damn, we don't want to buy apartments right now, we want to wait until they don't fall down, that isn't exactly a good recipe for, the construction industry trying to build new towers. And if they do build new towers, then the cost of construction is going to be so much higher. And, the potential for losses are there is out of the high price level. So it just looks like a mess.
Absolutely. So we've got this, we're over indebted, from a private perspective, governments are getting there, sort of globally. traditionally, I guess the ways to get out of this is you can try and inflate your way out of it. Arguably, that's what we've been trying to do for central banks have been trying to do for the last 10 years at least in Western countries and 25 years in Japan. So it's pretty clear we don't have the tools, or they don't have the tools to get out of that from an inflation perspective.
Inflation's gone. I mean, this is what the Reserve Bank and a whole lot of them can't cope with. And the reason is largely you've screwed the unions. You've screwed the bargaining capacity of workers to get higher wages to begin with. And one little trick in the real economy that turns up from my Minsky modelling of the economy is that rising debt, even if the money is being borrowed by the corporate sector, rising debt is paid for by a falling share of wages. And inflation is fundamentally driven by the wages share. Yep. If you have a falling level of wages, you're going to have falling inflation as well. And you're caught in this double bind of inadequate demand with falling wages at the same time. And they're now trying to inflate what they've deflated for the last 40 years. Well, good luck.
Mm. Yeah, like I said, inflation's the way out. We could let people default and let the companies, but the banks or the people that lent to those people go bust. It seemed to be that the financial crisis that was absolutely taboo, and we needed to, anyone, all the lenders needed to be bailed out. Sort of globally, so it seems as if that's sort of off the cards as well.
Yeah, we really are getting us to a situation where there's no way out. It's only if the impossible can go on forever that you're going to manage to get away with it. I'm looking at the level of credit growth right now in Australia, and what we had like the peak level of credit demand was back in '88, a long, long time ago. With corporate debt running at 17% of GDP, that was the level of increase in corporate debt, and household debt down at the 4 or 5% level. When the corporate stopped borrowing, which was back in 91, 92, all we've done is pumped the economy up by getting the household sector to borrow more, and we're now reaching, the end of their capacity to do that. And when you get to that point, the only choice is stagnation.
Mm. Well, I guess the other debt jubilees, but I think that's sort of we seem to be a couple of hundred years too late for that. Yep. the other part sort of seems to make sense to me in terms of a possible way out is convincing central banks to start giving money directly to the people or directly to governments, whether you want to call it MMT in terms of. Or at least in a step in the direction of MMT in terms of, yes, let's print money and give it directly to governments, or as you've spoken about before, and I've got a lot of support for printing money and giving it directly to consumers. Do you want to talk about the issues and, I guess, how we can see that might create you need to be able to create a certain level of inflation, don't you, without actually having the problem that you end up creating too much inflation.
Yeah, what you want to do is just reduce the level of private debt. I mean, this is the thing which mainstream economics will never get its head around. The level of household debt, the level of private debt is so high that the debt servicing costs are restraining people from actually borrowing in the very first place. So your credit demand runs up because debt is too high. That is the situation Australia is in now, and we'll be locked into it. So your solution is reduce the level of private debt. Now, if you reduce the level of private debt by people paying their debt down, every dollar they pay down reduces the money in existence and causes a fall in demand as well. So you get a Great Depression coming out of that. That was Irving Fisher's very effective and accurate explanation of what caused the Great Depression. If you want to do it without causing a Great Depression, you have to find a way of reducing debt without reducing demand. And my idea there is the idea of a modern debt jubilee, where you give everybody the same amount of money per capita. Those who have debt effectively have to pay their debt down. Those that don't have debt get a cash injection, which you could either let them spend if you needed the stimulus, or you could say you must use this money to buy newly issued corporate shares, which can only be used to cancel corporate debt. And you'd use a double whammy, reduced by the reduce corporate debt, reduce household debt, and increase the level of share ownership in the society, and in that sense, democratise capitalism to some extent. That's feasible, and there's bugger all chance of it happening.
That's right. And my twist on that, as I sent through to you, is that, look, I have support for that. I'd just like to make the payments taxable. So then you can say, well, we might help solve some inequality issues, but also you can fill some of the governments back up as well at the same time to let them pay down some of their debt.
Yeah, feasible. I mean, we have to reduce the level of debt, and this is with the thing. It isn't. I focus on private debt because the government's got the capacity, which the private sector doesn't have, to pay its debt with money it creates. The private sector tries creating money, even in Australia, it might end up going to jail. Though I'd have to wait and see what actually happens. You most likely get a knighthood instead. So it's something which is just impossible to you can't equate a government being in debt to a private individual being in debt, because a private individual has to earn money from somewhere else. The government can create its money to reduce its level, which is one reason why Japan's now at about 260% of a government debt to GDP level, and the economy is doing relatively fine. But at the same time, we have got too much debt in the economy overall. We should be looking at ways to reduce it and have more of an equity-based economy. And that's partly what the modern debt jubilee is directed at doing.
Mm. But I guess in a way, I mean, I think we're probably all saying, look, the economic pie is certainly big enough. Now we just need to talk about how we're dividing it up. And if you keep dividing it up and giving too much of the pie to the people with the most amount of money, because they're the ones who don't have the debt and have the equity, then those people aren't going to spend it. And you keep telling everyone else, with all the debt, you know, that they're not getting enough money then. And so that means they're going to reduce their demand to try and pay off the debt. And so it's a matter now of coming up with a methodology to say, how can we get more money into the, how can we get more money into the economy that sort of lifts all boats, so to speak? Yeah, as you said, if you gave everyone $10,000 tomorrow, there's no net effect on anyone's relative position, but it does mean that, you know, everyone's managed to pay their debt down a little bit. And now the people who are the most unequal can actually go out and start spending again to create. I suppose that's where it's coming from.
It is, but actually, I'm going to come up with something which I've just been working on recently, and nowhere near complete in the idea. But that's I mentioned. It's actually now's not a bad time to talk about global warming in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the cynicism. The only person who doesn't believe it's happening is Scott Morrison, and he's a religious advisor. Even the Liberal Party environment minister, who's actually got the same surname as me with different spelling. Was it Michael Keane?
Yes. It was Keane, definitely.
Yeah, global warming is actually happening. It's time to stop denying the science. We have to impose some sort of effective budget on carbon. But you can't do it using carbon pricing, as we saw in France. If you use carbon pricing, the poor go bankrupt and they get on the streets and you have riots, as we've seen with the Gilets jaunes. So a proposal that I've seen somebody else is actually working on as well, a person I'm now trying to bring into the policy world, is what I call basic carbon, which would be to create a central bank account where everybody who's a resident gets a central bank account with carbon, where you get an input into that, which might be quite possibly everybody annually gets 10 times the average consumption of carbon in that society. So it's when you buy anything, you get both a money price for it and a carbon price. You must pay both prices. So if you run out, then you've got to buy the carbon off somebody else. Now, if you give everybody the 10 times the average, nobody in the bottom 99% is going to pay anything. They're going to have excess carbon credits they can't use because they've run out of any of the money they can use to buy the stuff. So the top 1% would have to buy, who use far more than 10 times the average, would have to buy carbon credits off the poor. And that tied up with the modern, with the ideas of the debt jubilee as well, I think it'd get us out of two holes at once.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a twist then on that one as well for you, because I like the direction, but it sounds complex from the average punter. Whereas, because I always wondered with a lot of these ones where they were putting on, they were carbon offsets, but what was happening is you're charging one set of people and then paying the money to the government, so then the consumers end up paying. You're saying, well, why don't you just divert the money, just give everyone a check once a month or once a quarter or whatever it is, so you can go, yes, you've paid $10, you've paid $20 more on your electricity bill, and you've paid $50 more on your gas bill, and here's a check for whatever it is, $70 that everyone's getting, and then you can sort of the people that use less end up getting their check for $70 and not having to pay, and the people that that use more end up having to, you know, you paid $150 extra but only got a check back for $70. So, you know, it sort of helps encourage people to get away from carbon, but it also makes it direct that they can actually see the money coming in and feel it.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble about it with the money, you've still got the overall bias and the distribution of income that has happened as we've gone through this financial bubble in the last, well, in Australia's case, the last 60 years, 70 years. You've still got that inequality, and if you don't have find a way of reducing it, then, you know, it's going to be the poor who revolt against carbon taxes, as we saw in France.
Yeah. Well, and the other problem coming for that is that obviously as solar power gets cheaper and cheaper and battery power gets cheaper and cheaper, you end up in this situation where if the richer people can afford to actually say, yeah, okay, I'll buy, if electricity prices keep going up, I can afford to buy solar panels plus sticker batteries on my house, and now I'm not being charged the extra amount, whereas the poor people are the ones who have to actually, yeah, can't afford to do it, so they have to keep bearing that increased costs as well.
That's right, and that's the danger. I mean, if you get to the stage where we have to seriously ration carbon at some point, and it's the poor who pay for it, we'll go the way of other civilizations that have tried to screw the poor indefinitely. They fail. So anyway, this is I think we have to look now at something that combines not just something to reduce the private debt levels, but something that addresses climate change and carbon as well. And that's why I'm trying to think of schemes that combine the two.
Yeah, Steve, that's a fantastic bit of thought leadership, I think, on a massive problem. It's almost a human carbon right as much as everyone has a human right. They've got a human carbon right as well. So I'd be fascinated to see where that goes. Just a quick one, obviously mindful of your time, but you touched on before the Atlas of Economic Complexity, and in reference obviously to Australia's gradual decline, probably even faster than that, down the list. I just thought, and maybe with the hope of finishing on a high note, you've spent quite a bit of time offshore as an Australian, I guess, looking in. It'd be great to hear your thoughts perhaps on the future prospects of Australia and perhaps in reference to our declining manufacturing base. Have you got anything for us there?
That to me, I mean, we've screwed up manufacturing right from the very outset. The whole idea of letting five foreign manufacturing companies set up shop in Australia and produce into the Australian market was bloody insane. So we always had far too small car manufacturers and not domestically investing either. We've screwed it all the way down the line. I would hope that we can use something based on the technology we developed in solar panels. I mean, you know the name Martin Green? Do you know Martin Green?
Yes.
No, he's the guy who invented amorphous silicon as solar cells and held the world record for many years in terms of the efficiency of cell-conversion. He's at the University of New South Wales. He couldn't get funding for Australian solar cell development, so one of his main students went back to China, and that's why China now dominates the global market in solar cells. So the number of opportunities we've let slip are just ridiculous in Australia. I just don't see any chance for thought leadership or industrial leadership coming out of Australia. People still use the lucky country as though it's a positive. And if they'd never read Donald Horne, and the lucky country, the line of the lucky country was something I quoted to Donald very late in writing the book, and his little punchline was, Australia's a country that relies on luck to make up for its mediocre managers. Well, I'm sorry, I think the mediocre managers have won.
But I think as well, and I'm not sure whether it's that book, but it talks about Australian politicians being terrible managers of success. But when a crisis happens, they're actually not too bad. And so what we really need is a good crisis to clear out our current dead wood and bring in some people to try and fix it. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thanks for your time today, Steve. Would you mind just sharing with us and our audience how people can follow you and some of the work you've been doing?
Yep. So, the main thing is I'm crowdfunded these days. I've left the university sector because it's been totally ruined by too many bureaucrats and too much government control. So I'm a critic of things like HECS and so on, what it's done to the economy. So I left the university sector last year, and I'm supported on a crowdfunding site called Patreon. So if you go to www.patreon.com/profstevekeen, you'll find me there. I post almost everything that I do free. The one thing that actually people have to subscribe to see are my podcast with Phil Dobby. They're for the people paying $10 a month and up. But Otherwise, virtually everything I post on there is publicly available.
Fantastic. All right, excellent. Well, thanks again for your time, and we look forward to getting you on to the next one.
Yep, for sure. It's been good fun.
So, Damien, terrific 40-odd minutes there spent this morning with Professor Keane, coming, he's obviously very gracious with his time. It was quite late in Amsterdam, I think, when we shot that first thing this morning. So what were your thoughts?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. I think there was a couple of things sort of really stood out to me from an investment perspective. First, was it interesting to note his thoughts on that Bank of England being sort of the closest to the to what's going on, and with an election sort of coming up there and Brexit, and we've seen a lot of movement in currencies and markets over there. That's sort of one area which we're actually quite looking at quite closely in terms of where can we see some mispricing within that market, and can we use the election and other factors that are coming through to actually pick up some stocks there at relatively attractive prices. So, you know, the fact that you've got a central bank that's relatively forward-looking potentially some one more net positive for as a reason to be looking at that UK market for stocks.
Sure.
He spoke a bit about the China risks, and so obviously I think we're sort of similar in terms of the problems with having such a large debt burden. I guess he was probably a little bit more circumspect on the risks than I am. I think I'm probably a little bit more. I'm probably a little bit more wary of the risks associated with the Chinese market. I mm-hmm. think there are limits to the debt, and there are limits to, I think that the more they're going to borrow, and we'll actually start putting pressure on the currency, and with Trump trying to use the currency as a bit of a weapon as well, you know, too much devaluation will just end up in more tariffs, and we're already seeing a decent amount of industrial production come out of that system. So I think there's probably a little bit more to be concerned about there. I think he's certainly, I think we're on the same side of the page in terms of the debt, but as I said, he's, I guess, less concerned about the risks, whereas I'm, and feels like they probably will manage their way out of it. Mm. I think there's a pretty good chance they'll follow the path he's got, but I think there's a non-zero chance, and it's probably, you know, a reasonably large chance that they don't get it right.
Mm, okay, sure.
And then the final one on the Australian debt side. I think it was interesting to note his thoughts that, you know, if Australia manages to get out of this without the construction sector booming, so if it's only a house price driven economic boom,
yep.
And everything else is down, that will be a world first, as we thought, and that the odds of that seem very low, not zero, but they do seem very low to me.
Yep.
And also he's, you know, confirming our views that with a very traditional central bank in Australia, he's sort of focused on using tools that have basically been shown not to work elsewhere.
Mm.
You can sort of see the future for the Australian economy in terms of just following down the path of just grinding lower growth, trying to use monetary policy, it not working, and then having to eventually rely on something else. But
yep.
you would like to think that having seen this play out in Japan and then play out in the US and play out in Europe, you know, you've got all these previous cases that you could follow, and Australia's sort of been lagging behind that because of the Chinese growth in prior years managed to hold our economy up, and we didn't end up in that same trap.
Yep.
As we're grinding towards that trap,
whereas our luck's running out,
it doesn't seem as if the central bank has sort of taken those lessons and decided let's try something different.
Yep.
They seem to be saying let's try the same thing as what everyone else did, which didn't work,
and hope for the best.
So yeah, I mean, having said that, you know, I think there is a good argument to say while you can say these things haven't worked in terms of recovering the economy, they might have averted disaster.
Mm.
But the question is, would you be better off with a shorter, sharper recession and then a recovery from there, or are you better off just grinding out for decades?
Yep. And is it worth sending Professor Steve's details over to Governor Phil vis-a-vis the direct deposits from the central bank in terms of MMT, do you think?
Look, I think there will be eventually some... I think that's the easiest way to get out of this. Mm. The first easiest way, the most easy way to get out of the situation is to generate inflation, which yep. is what everyone's trying to do.
Yep.
I guess some central banks thought, well, Japan didn't quite do it right. If they just had done more and faster and sooner and all that type of stuff, it would have been fine.
more petrol on the fire, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the last decade has sort of shown, no, that wasn't the case.
Yep.
And so now we're still in the sort of grind higher stage. I think that it's the next crisis where people then go, okay, we've run out of monetary ammunition. What do we do now?
Yep.
And that's where I think some of these MMTs or direct money transfers or whatever it is, quantitative easing for the people effectively, printing money and giving it to either governments or people will be the next thing that comes out as a solution. I just think you're going to need a crisis before you get there.
Yep.
Okay. It is too much of a step for traditionalists to take
on board. Okay, no, fantastic. All right, thanks very much. And of course, for those listening in, head over to Nucleus Wealth and check out our details there. If you're interested in investing with Nucleus Wealth, you can check out our portal. It takes about 10 minutes to run through a prospective investment, and you've of course get all the information. You don't need to make a decision. Now, coming up next week, we've got Kevin Muir. So after a long career intertwining technology and securities trading, Kevin went out on his own prior to the dot-com bust and has spent the last 20 years successfully running his own money and sharing these experiences through his daily Macro Tourist newsletter. So we've got him on board for the next show. Really looking forward to that. It's same bat time, same bat channel, Thursday the 19th of December next week, and head over to the nucleuswealth.com/webinar page to watch that and also have your questions answered live. Look forward to seeing you there.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.